I'm radio man, and I can do as much or as little as you want.
Hello, this is tape 3. Careful. Tape 3, side 5. We're at Barry Paris' home. Gabby Dinman and Mary Harrison. I will be doing the interviewing. I'm Mary Harrison. Today is August 30th, 1998, and we are with Barry, and we ended our last tape talking about Russian films and Eisenstein, and Barry's going to give us a 5-minute rundown of Russian films opposed to Western films or American films, and he said he's going to give us, he could give us a 3-hour version, he's going to give us a 5-minute version.
Okay, it can be about Russian history, Russian film history, which was my real area. And the whole reason I became a Slavic language major was because my real interest was Russian East European film. And so if you're going to know about Russian East European film, you better know Russian and other East European languages. So I went to this institute in Munich. But anyway, the history of my paper there was called Soviet Cinema, or Russian Film Industry and Soviet Cinematography, or the other way around. And the gist of it is, in a nutshell, is that it can be said, it is said that Americans invented the technology and the genre of film as an art, but Russians perfected film as an art form. And the single most important man who did it was Eisenstein, Sergei Eisenstein. Unbelievably brilliant filmmaker, and not only in terms of its construction and composition, but all the devices, montage, assembly of film for political purposes in the most important ones such as Battleship Potemkin, 10 Days That Shook the World, the great Soviet propaganda films. Eisenstein was the first one to do that, to realize that what Lenin had said 20 years earlier, which was when he first saw a movie in about 1908 or 9, this is the art form, this is the form that will advance Marxist propaganda and communist theory more and better and greater than any other. Completely right. Because that's the art form that was accessible to the masses. So Eisenstein did this from both an artistic and a political standpoint, and was followed by the others, such as Pudovkin, the Ukrainian Dovzhenko, etc., etc. And that was the gist of my thesis.
Was he used, or did he really believe in the political aspect of this? Propaganda, both.
He fully believed in it, and he was highly utilized, highly used, and it was tremendously successful because you could take a little film projector to a tiny village anywhere in Russia where you couldn't take a play or a great book because people couldn't read, or you couldn't take, but if you took a little projector and screened something, they would watch mesmerized and take in the message if it was visual without any need to know how to read or write. It was just the most powerful way to get a political message to people.
So, did they export some of his films? They were all, because he and was, it was acceptable. It wasn't like some of the novels that were written where the Russians didn't want the Pasternak and...
Exactly, because Eisenstein completely conformed to the to the agenda, firmly believed in it, supported it, endorsed it, and helped foster it. And then the rest of the world, namely Western Europe, not America, was almost equally spellbound and fascinated by it for the film media, for its revolutionary film media devices. The content you could take or leave, the political content, you didn't have to buy the communist message, but you could. You don't have to whisper. So the rest of the world, film world that is, to lesser or greater extent, copied, utilized, adopted Eisenstein's devices. Montage became a completely acceptable method or a technique in film in every country in the world.
So we're talking the end of the 20s?
Middle 20s through the end of the 20s.
Okay, now then came Hitler and came his major propagandist, the wonderful photographer, what is her name?
Leni Riefenstahl.
Yes, and how does that tie in there?
Very much, very similar, very relatedly, because Leni Riefenstahl was also a brilliant film propagandist, and probably second only to the Russians. The Nazis utilized film for the exact same purposes, only for their horrible, hideous agenda. And she made Triumph of the Will, which is one of the most astounding, powerful, and successful documentaries advancing the Nazi agenda. She's still alive at 198 or whatever.
But she
and,
is, I think she is.
She was thrown in. Yeah, I thought Peter Viertel was the husband of Deborah Carr, both of whom were close friends of Garbo and real good, real helpful to me in the Garbo book. Peter told me, but he was a Marine, he was a Marine Army Sergeant Major or something. During the end of the war, he was in charge of going to arrest Leni Riefenstahl once Munich was captured. It was his assignment to arrest her, and he did so, and he had fabulous stories about her.
Like?
Weeping, gnashing of teeth. All I did was do it, you know, only following orders, the old story. And, tell it to the judge, come with us. She spent a couple of years in jail.
Okay, then now I can't help. There's some rumbling again. Now, can you then tie this in with Barbelsberg, the German?
With what?
Barbelsberg, the filmmakers of the Blue Angel, of the German filmmakers.
Like von Sternberg,
yes,
and Dietrich.
Yes, yes.
Well, it all ties in because it was so close in time. I mean, Blue Angel was 1930, the first year of sound, second year of sound. Von Sternberg was... yes, I can tie it simply. I'm trying to do it simply because these are the subjects of which huge volumes. But to simplify it and to try to get to the most single important thing, the name of the medium is motion picture. It's about pictures that move. It was about pictures that moved only. From the beginning, which was 1897 or so when it was invented, until 1927 or 8 when sound came in. The minute sound came in, everything shifted. It became, I advanced a theory in Louise Brooks that there is virtually no relationship between silent films and sound film. Because after sound came in, it was all about words. Before sound came in, it was all about pictures, images.
And action,
and movement. Not words. There were very few, in the best silent films, there were very few titles, very few inner titles. Because you told the story in pictures, in images. After sound came in, all anybody wanted to do was hear words. The novelty of it was so powerful that the worst sound film with lots of dialogue was more popular than the best silent film with the most beautiful images. And that is what changed film history as a word. Eventually, it got back a little bit of the balance. Now, it has gotten way out of hand in the bed. But you see what I mean? The point is moving to telling a story in images. Film is much more related to ballet. Silent film is much more related to ballet than it is to
sound. It's choreographed, actually.
Choreographed.
Yes.
And that's why Louise Brooks was so brilliantly successful in film, because she was a dancer. She didn't have to talk. She could have talked just fine, but she didn't have to. She moved, and that's what fascinated people, because this dumb flibbertigibbet, not dumb, this feisty little flibbertigibbet moves so brilliantly on the stage and on film. Whereas you could take Sarah Bern, or let's say, who's the great dramatic, Well, no, she was a great film. I'm thinking of, you could take a great actress.
How about Duncan, Isadora Duncan?
She would have been great if she'd only made film.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking about the other way around, like Catherine Cornell or somebody, one of the great old actresses, Babe Bernhardt. Put her on stage, brilliant. Put her in a film, terrible, because she was moving for hundreds and hundreds of people on the stage. On film, you would move for essentially one person because you 30-foot image on the screen. And if you didn't have a sense of that, you looked ludicrous in the film. You know, the exaggerated, what most people, when they think of silent film, they think of the Perils of Pauline and exaggerated emotional, which there were a lot of lousy silent films. The brilliant ones were the ones who knew that the tiniest movement they made was going to be 30 feet tall on a movie screen, and it better be subtler.
Now, what would happen, I think Sid Caesar, if I'm mistaken, tried to make a silent film. Wasn't it? It was one film where there were no words spoken.
Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks, okay.
Called Silent Movie.
Exactly.
It's
okay.
Hilarious.
And Marcel Marceau said yes.
And what?
No. Marcel Marceau.
Oh, yeah.
The mom.
He said no. That was the only word in the whole pitch.
That's right. Marceau was the only one who spoke. I forgot that. I love that
now,
movie.
Now, what would happen then if we... What would happen now? I mean, this was certainly an experimental thing, and it was something different. What would happen if we went back to this now? We're all so sound.
I think it would be fascinating. And a few people have or have tried. Well, first of all, a few people have gone back to black and white, which is also a correct idea.
I was going to bring
black
you
black and white color. Is similar to the difference between a black and white movie and color is almost as great as the difference between a silent and a sound film, because images, film is shadow. Black, when you put it in black and white, you have to examine the composition of the shadow. When you put it in color, your eyes spend their time and your mind fascinated by the color. Color is mesmerizing.
It's distracting.
And you will then concentrate on the color as opposed to the images and the composition. So yeah, and that's why Spielberg made Schindler's List in black and white. That's why people make Coppola. You know, there are current films that are made in black and white for specifically visual composition reasons. It's a good thing to return to that because it's about pictures.
So what did you think of Technicolor as it came?
Technicolor? Well, it's fabulous. It's gorgeous. It's a major invention, and used properly, it's one, you know, Gone with the Wind is the most beautiful. There's nothing you want to do more than sit and watch the images in Gone with the Wind. And they're fabulous. And that's because they're in a brilliant story that's brilliantly directed with brilliant acting. And it works. And it's proper. And it's beautiful. But, you know, you can go to Arnold Schwarzenegger's The Terminator, and all you do is sit there and watch the explosions and the color. And it's not so beautiful, and it's not so important. So color is a wonderful invention. You can't be so conservative. You can't be Marcia Davenport and say, you know, still call it the gramophone, and want, you know, want color to go out of existence. It's just that it shouldn't be the dominant.
Is it then, do you think, isn't it sort of the same with children toys? You know, we went from these wonderful simple toys that were wooden, without numbers, without color, and the child used its imagination. Is this what we're doing?
I think that's a good analogy. In other words, the more sophisticated and complex the thing is, the less you have to fill in with your imagination. Well, you know what else? It's like, even better example is radio versus television. When you have the Lone Ranger on radio, your mind, or Amos and Andy, or anything else, your mind, you fill in your mind what the people look like and what the action is, and you listen to the radio, and your mind works to see the images. Now, when it's on TV, they still may be pretty good programs, which in fact they were, both of them, but you see the point. Then it's, oh, here's the image, oh, all right, I'll watch it. You don't have to interact. It's interactive. And the same thing with sound, the most important thing between silent and sound. When John Gilbert and Greta Garbo talked to each other and made love on screen in a silent film, you filled in their voices in your mind. Whatever you wanted her to sound like, she sounded like. Whatever you wanted him to sound like, if you wanted him to be a macho guy, he sounded like. Once sound came in, and her voice is beautiful, it's okay. His voice is a little too high, kind of a high tenor. It's, oh, that's not what I thought he sounded. That's stupid. I don't like his voice. You know, it ruined his career. Ruined hundreds of careers. Because the viewer filled it in his or her mind before.
So you don't think it's necessary to know that somebody's going to be attacked by a thief as they're walking down the street? You know, the sound effects that we hear.
Yeah. Well, it's not necessary. It may be effective, or it may be stupid. But yeah, it's not necessary. If you have the sound effects and want to use them and use them well, that's all right. You can use them to enhance, but you can also use them to screw up. And no, it's not necessary. What's necessary is just what you, the director or the author, think is necessary to tell the story. And if sound effects help that, use them. And if they detract from that, use them anyway. That's Hollywood's theory now.
Okay.
But it's not necessary.
Okay. Is there anything that I didn't ask in this area that you'd like to comment on? Or?
No, I think you zeroed in on the whole thing. And I just mentioned for your record that... to avoid boring you at greater length, I believe it is chapter 5 of Louise Brooks, there is about a 6-page, I must say, carefully written essay on exactly this subject that goes into a lot more detail. If you or anyone is interested, my whole theory that I've sort of quickly outlined for you is all put down there carefully, and it goes into it in much more detail, so I don't need to go over.
Oh, you mentioned something in the interview with Adler, that the American public is obsessed with movies. What does that address that a little?
What? Well, it's such an obvious fact. What do you mean about it, in terms of...
Well...
See what I mean?
Arthur, what's an obsession? Obsession with movie means what? How do you define what... How you? I mean, to me, it's self-explanatory,
yeah.
But this is an oral history, and I...
Okay,
what
okay,
is your,
I see what you mean. Yeah, and I think what she meant... Well, I can't speak for her. Yes, I can. I'm always speaking for her.
Sounded negative to me.
It is very negative.
Okay.
And the reason why is because she regards film as an inferior medium to theater, which, of course, it is in terms... Oh, should I get closer and not stick my knees up? Well, Stella completely regarded film as an inferior medium to theater, which it is for an actor, for obvious reasons. You cannot employ the same degree of talent and skill when you are doing choppy scenes out of order with 1,500 stops between them as you can in a continuous performance on stage, right? And also she was contemptuous of the money difference, the fact that you could beat Tyrone Power. Well, he wasn't that bad. Let's pick somebody, Cornell Wilde, one of those people, or Kim Novak, and make $2 million
and
for
they couldn't act, could they?
Right, and you could be Helen, you could be Stella Adler, and make $10,000 for the same period of time. So there was a resentment there, and there still is, of course, between theater people and film people for good reason. You know, Schwarzenegger gets $5 million a movie. It's probably a lot more than that now. Versus, Bernadette Peters or someone on Broadway gets $40,000 for eight performances a week. It's not fair.
Hey, stop it, stop it.
Oh, this will be great on your ticket.
No, that's fine. I have a cat.
I'm not talking to either Mary or Gavin. I'm talking to this incredibly stupid cat that we've told 500 times not to. You're going upstairs. So there's a resentment about the economic unfairness. But basically it's an artistic thing. She regarded the media, the two genres rather, the two art forms as high and low. Oh, and the reason though why film, America, your original question, why are Americans so obsessed with film, is simply a sociocultural and economic one. In other words, and this is why I'm obsessed with film. And that's because... Mom, stop it. Go away. That's because film is the only truly great mass art form that anybody, anywhere, every little town in Kansas, Pennsylvania, New York, from New York to California to Slobodka, has movie theaters and people go to movies. Ballet, one of the most beautiful art forms, has, by comparison, 0.01% of the number of audience. Sculpture, poetry, even theater, symphonic music, the numbers are that big, very small, compared to the numbers of people who have access to film and who see films. So that from an impact standpoint, what films do, the widespread repercussions that film has is more than all the other arts combined in terms of number.
And nasty video and TV.
Including video,
yes.
And TV is even greater.
So it comes almost to you. You don't even have to go to it anymore.
Exactly. And now with video and TV, the one good thing now about the development of television, video, and cable is that at least you can see all the great movies on TV now. It's not good to see them on a postage-sized screen, but it's better to see them that way than not at all.
Exactly.
And millions of people are doing so. Whereas, how many people are going to see the original Streetcar Named Desire or Fontaine and Nureyev dance Romeo and Juliet or, it's just tiny, tiny. It's New York, it's the two coasts.
Exactly.
And maybe a little
sort
bit
of
in
New
between.
Era, yeah.
Yeah. So you see, that I think is the gist of why film is so crucial. And again, it relates to the Eisenstein, Lenin, Marxist theory of this is the medium that's going to get to the people. You want to get a message across? You use film, you don't have them do it in a ballet, because that'll only be seen by the intellectuals in Petersburg.
The masses are going to see this.
Exactly.
Okay, Marilyn Monroe, you...
We had an affair, she and I, yes. No, what, I'm sorry.
How lucky.
I don't talk about it usually.
you really did not comment on whether she had ability. That picture is wonderful. I think she was exquisite, and the first thing I think of is what good does it do if you yourself don't know how exquisite?
Yes,
she obviously
right.
didn't know how exquisite she was.
No, look at
what
that.
What did you
picture.
Think of her? Oh, it's
stunning. And the silk screen was made, Bert Stern, by the man who took the picture.
Uh-huh.
Bert Stern, he was a Life magazine photographer. He took the photograph for Life and then later did that.
He did that whole series for mm-hmm. yeah.
It's an extraordinary picture. It's an extraordinary face.
What did you think of her?
I adored her. How could you not adore her? And I just saw for the second time in 2 weeks All About Eve, in which yes. one of her very first movies, she has a tiny part. But so wonderful. She is what she is, although a lot smarter. The dumb blonde, but not so dumb. In the end, yes, so dumb. But not so dumb. A great scene where she's on this. All she cares about, everything's going on around her. You know, Betty Davis and all this, Ann Baxter and Georgetown. And there's all this drama. And she's there. All she cares about is trying to get a drink from the butler as he keeps going back and forth. And she says, waiter. Waiter. And Sandra's son says, darling, we don't call him a waiter, he's the butler. And she said, well, I can't call him butler, because what if that's somebody's name, butler? And Sandra says, and he says, darling, you have a point. It's an idiotic point, but it's a point.
But her presence was known.
Her presence is incredible in 5 minutes on screen.
Yes, yes.
This is a wonderful, wonderful, astonishing creature.
Did you meet her? Did you?
No. I wish I had.
Yeah.
I was 14 when she died. Remember the movies? You probably do too.
Yeah.
It's almost like the Kennedy killing. I remember I was in, appropriately enough, a movie theater, the lobby of the Bel Air Theater in Maryland with my mother and sister. We were visiting my brother and watching some dumb movie like Ocean's 11. And I went out for popcorn, and the woman at the counter said, did you hear about Marilyn? She's dead. It was like she just disappeared. She snuffed herself out.
To show how my asking you if you knew her is an indication of how unaware I am of the passing of time, how long she's been dead. That's really scary.
64.
Okay, I didn't even think of that.
No, not 62, right? She sang Happy Birthday in 62, right, to Kennedy? She
You're
died
right.
in 62.
Exactly, 63.
It was 62, because I was 14. I was born in 1948, and this was 1962, August, as I recall. It was as shocking as almost as the Kennedy assassination, you know, or the James Dean car crash.
Stella Adler...
I can refer you also, while we're doing proper oral history and references to the, I must say, fabulous section of the Tony Curtis book in which he discusses making Some Like It Hot with her.
Oh, really?
Which, in my opinion, is the single best section of the Tony Curtis book.
All right, we'll read it. She was amazing in it. Stella Adler mentions three films, and one of them is The Thin Man, one was Toast of the Town. Do you remember the third?
Yeah, it's, she only made three films. And I just got Shadow of the Thin Man in the mail and video and watched it. If you hang in 1 second, I'll get it.
Okay.
It's in the...
All right, now, the book that you...
My book, Stella's 3,000 pages of lectures that I edited for Knopf that are coming out in March of 99. They're brand new. Take a quick read of that. Are you sure I can't get you a drink?
You know what? How about some water?
Water? I don't know about water, but we come up with
that. Yeah, okay, the three movies, I got this from my notes. The three movies that Stella Adler made were?
Shadow of the Thin Man, Love on Toast, and My Girl Tisa.
And what about Toast of the Town?
Nope.
It's not her. Okay, then I...
Nope, just similar title to the other one.
Okay.
Shadow.
Shadow of the Thin, it was the fourth in the series. Not the best. Not bad, but it's her scene that's so wonderful in it. She plays kind of a, she's a racetrack chick who has a sleazy boyfriend who's getting in trouble, and she's from New York somewhere, but she's putting on airs. And then she talks to William Powell. She pretends she affects this very high-class accent, but he gets to her, and that's the gist of the scene, how it ends, if you want to see.
Okay, I'd like to.
And
okay.
She's beautiful. Stunningly beautiful.
I loved Luther Adler. He was one of my very favorite actors. This is my own question. The public affairs books, Harper, Simon & Schuster, all these sellouts. How is this going to affect publishing, but also how will it affect you, if at all?
You mean all the corporate buyouts and takeovers?
Yes.
It's weird.
The Germans are buying
the publishing. Yes, they now own everything. Well, it's fascinating. It disturbs me a lot philosophically, but I must say it has not affected my relationship with Knopf at all. Knopf is my main publisher. Louise Brooks, Garbo, Franklin Pierce book. Vicki Wilson's my editor. I'm one of the Stella Adler book. They asked me to do. So they're the most important to me. And they were, of course, for years and years, the top-of-the-line publisher, independent in New York. They still are the top of the line. Bought out by then Random House 20 years ago. Now, since bought out by whoever that German guy. But for some reason, all of these companies the corporations that have taken over Knopf have never interfered with anything internally. So that Knopf still runs very independently in much the same way as it did when Alfred Knopf and Robert Gottlieb were running it, and now it's Victoria Wilson and Sonny Mehta. And there hasn't been a single change in my relationship with them. I have the same good relationship, the same sort of specialty there. They do very few books compared to the most publishers, big ones, put out something like 150 titles a year. Knopf does about 75. And they therefore get more attention and they're considered higher quality. It's a very snobbish outfit, which of course I love. And they have been wonderful, and they still are, and I can't detect any change. But in general, I don't like the idea that now Random House, now Doubleday and Random House merge. Everything is one corporate, you know, two. In the end, everything in the world is going to be owned by AT&T or Sony, or Ted Turner. One of the three. They will own everything. They practically do already.
And what's so tricky is they manipulate most people. We have no idea, usually, what this is.
No idea.
Now, was Robert Gottlieb with The New Yorker?
Yes, indeed. He was the 25-year longtime editor-in-chief of Knopf at the time of my Louise Brooks book. He is the one who commissioned and accepted Louise Brooks from me, and I was so thrilled because he's a legend in the business, the greatest editor in the business. And then 6 months later, right when I was just getting into the Louise Brooks research, my agent calls in. I have to tell you, Gottlieb's leaving Knopf, and also he was to be my personal editor in the book. He's leaving Knopf to become editor of The New Yorker.
What? He's leaving
Knopf? I'm devastated. And whine. And the agent said, Aaron, you're such an idiot. Don't you realize now he's the editor of The New Yorker? So we went there, and he's the one that accepted all my pieces for The New Yorker.
And then what happened when Tina Brown?
Then I was on the outs because I was one of Gottlieb's boys. And Tina Brown didn't give me the time of day.
Are you glad she's gone?
I'm thrilled that she's gone. Thrilled that she's gone. Plus, I did like the fact, the art and the byline. Those were good. But I didn't like the other changes. She cheapened the magazine.
That's what everybody says.
Yeah, it's true.
I subscribe to
you. So bye-bye, Tina. And the new guy, David Remnick, I've never met, but sounds like a good guy. I'm anxious to meet him.
And where's Gottlieb now?
He's semi-retired, but he does his own. Certain people he continues to edit. You know, this is the man who edited all of the John le Carré books, Toni Morrison, Heller, including a little book called Catch 22. That was Bob Gottlieb's edit. This man has edited the greatest people in the country. I'm so thrilled to be affiliated with him. He also saved me from the Post-Gazette. Rescued me.
Okay.
He's a good pal.
Oh, both of us were talking today. What?
I'm listening. Keep talking. I'm just going there. No, keep talking. I'm listening in the next one.
You know me. I'm jumping around. What were you going to ask?
Describe what a collector is and what prompts a collector to become a collector.
A collector, as in all my buttons and stuff?
Yes.
Wait
a minute.
I'll find it later.
And the roses?
Well, let's see. Let me.
That's what you said. I was reciting.
Yeah, no, that's what I said, but let me be a little more. Collectors are, you know, by the psychological profile, collectors are anal retentive, fairly neurotic people who have to keep things, hoard things, and collect. And I was
premature toilet training.
Yeah, right. Something like that. I don't know. Dr. Freud would have to explain. And I was an avid compulsive stamp collector from the age of about 4.
Excuse me.
Because other members of my family were, and they had a lot of correspondence. Oh, because my mother was Miss Manna's secretary, and he would get all this international correspondence, and she'd clip the stamps off and bring it up. I was always this fanatic stamp collector. That was my big, I spent my entire childhood over a stamp book. And also then, and my father and the family were very interested in politics, Democratic politics, and it was all, you know, books and stuff, everything about Roosevelt and Rose. So I collected over the years, didn't collect, but just sort of kept and assembled and saw this political stuff. So that when I was an early teen in Kansas, Rick Geary, the National Lampoon artist, my best friend and I, had political button collection. And this was in the early 60s, 62 and 3. And we decided that in 64, the election of 64 with the famous Goldwater Johns, that we were going to deliberately go around and collect from the campaign headquarters all. We were going to pretend to be a Johnson supporter or a Goldwater supporter, whatever you needed to be, and go in and say, can we have some buttons and stuff? And that's what we did. And so we got lots of material. And then you drive around Kansas, all these great little junk stores and barn sales and antique stores, and you'd find, oh, look, here's a Harding button, or here's a William McKinley pin. So we started to collect the older stuff at a time when not many people were